Hamas's political leader killed in Tehran.
Well, Israel is not taking responsibility and probably will not take responsibility.
Plus, the U.S. calls for calm and a return to negotiations.
I think nothing takes away from the importance of, as I said a moment ago, getting to the ceasefire, which is manifestly in the interests of the hostages and bringing them home. It's manifestly in the interests of Palestinians who are suffering terribly every single day. Children, women, men in Gaza who've been caught in this crossfire of Hamas's making.
And later, an update from Kyiv, Olympic security, and a look at climate change and politics. Today is Wednesday, July 31st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Iranian state television on Wednesday announced the death of the political leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, in an early morning strike in Tehran. Iran's Revolutionary Guards confirmed the death hours after Haniyeh attended a swearing-in ceremony for Iran's new president. In a statement read on Iranian state TV, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said that Israel has prepared the ground for harsh punishment for itself, and we consider it our duty to avenge the blood of him who is martyred in the land of Islamic Republic of Iran. As of now, Israel has not commented publicly or taken responsibility for the assassination of Haniyeh. The United States is urging calm. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said that he would like to see diplomacy prevail.
Yeah, you know, I said I don't think war is inevitable. I maintain that. I think there's always room and opportunities for diplomacy, and I'd like to see parties pursue those opportunities. And certainly what we've seen along the border, the northern border with Israel, over time, that's, you know, that's been a concern of ours. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that we keep things from turning into a broader conflict throughout the region.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that regardless of the events in Tehran, getting a ceasefire deal is still the most important goal.
Well, of course, I've seen seen the reports, and what I can tell you right now is I think nothing takes away from the importance of, as I said a moment ago, getting to the ceasefire, which is manifestly in the interests of the hostages and bringing them home. It's manifestly in the interests of Palestinians who are suffering terribly every single day, children, women, men in Gaza who've been caught in this crossfire of Hamas's making. It's profoundly in the interest of trying to put things on a better path, not only in Gaza, but actually throughout the region, because so much is tied to what's happening in Gaza right now.
However, with Haniyeh's involvement in those negotiations, it's unclear when they can continue. All of this follows an airstrike in Beirut that killed a senior Hezbollah leader. Joining me with the latest from Jerusalem is VOA's Linda Gradstein.
So the target and the person who was killed was Fuad Shukr, who was a senior commander of Hezbollah, and Israel says that he was the person who was responsible for the Hezbollah attack over the weekend that killed 12 Druze children and teenagers who were playing soccer in northern Israel. Hezbollah has not taken responsibility for that attack, but both Israel and the U.S. say that the rocket used in that attack was the one that only Hezbollah has. And Israel had threatened retaliation. In addition, several of his bodyguards were killed. And the fact that it was deep in Beirut, in the Dahiya suburb of Beirut, which is a Hezbollah stronghold, sort of ups the ante as far as Hezbollah is concerned. Israel and Hezbollah, in the almost 10 months that this war has been going on, have been very careful to try to target military targets rather than civilian targets. And of course, this attack that killed these children is an exception. And at the same time, Israel has refrained from striking Beirut except for one other situation. So it definitely increased the tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. Hezbollah said that they would respond. The person killed was also involved in the bombing of the Marine barracks in 1983. He is one of the most senior people in Hezbollah. Some people in Israel were calling him the top commander, but then others said, no, he's just one of the top, not the most senior, but it definitely increased the tension. And Hezbollah has about 150,000 rockets that can reach all parts of Israel. So there's definitely concern that there will be sort of a large-scale missile strike.
In a related story, in other news, Ismail Haniyeh was killed in Tehran. Israel has not claimed responsibility for that, but all eyes are on Israel. Are we expecting a statement? What do we know from the Israeli side about what happened in Tehran?
Well, Israel is not taking responsibility and probably will not take responsibility. Israel has acted repeatedly in Iran dozens of times to assassinate, whether it was people involved in the Iranian nuclear program, which Israel sees as a strategic existential threat, whether it was Hamas people. But the fact that this was done in Tehran, Haniyeh was there because of the swearing-in ceremony of the new president of Iran, but it's definitely kind of a slap in the face to Iran. It does showcase Israel's both intelligence capabilities and operational capabilities. And I spoke to Amos Yadlin, the former head of military intelligence, and he said that Israel's deterrence had been kind of wiped out on October 7th when thousands of Hamas gunmen surged across the border, and this is a step towards bringing that back. That said, there is an expectation that there will be an Iranian response, whether it will be directly by Iran, which seems less likely, or by one of its proxies. And it's also possible that it won't necessarily be in Israel. It could be an attack on an Israeli embassy abroad. It could be attacks on the Israeli athletes at the Olympics. And so security at all kinds of Israel-related institutions has been stepped up. But people have not been told to stay near bomb shelters. There have been no changes in a number of people who are allowed to, gather together. People were told to exercise caution, but there have been no official sort of rules about changing day-to-day behavior.
So we've heard for months now that Israel is not looking for a wider escalation in the conflict, especially with Hezbollah. Lebanon and Hezbollah and Israel all have been saying they don't want a larger war, yet these tit-for-tat attacks keep on happening. Is this the straw that breaks the camel's back? Is this what opens the floodgates?
I don't think so, quite honestly. I think that Israel, the fact that it struck in Beirut showed that it has capability, but that it was a very limited strike. There were very few, if any, civilians killed. So I think Israel clearly doesn't want a war, and I don't think Hezbollah or Lebanon does either. I mean, Israel has also said that if there is an all-out conflict, meaning ground troops and things like that, that Israel would see all of Lebanon as a target, would hit Lebanese infrastructure. And the other thing is that the sense is that if there's a ceasefire with Gaza, the fighting with Hezbollah stops immediately. And in fact, the Israeli foreign minister today issued a statement calling on international pressure for the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which calls for Hezbollah to be north of the Litani River. And, Hezbollah has just been sort of ignoring that that UN resolution. So I think Israel still prefers to deal with this, diplomatically. And Hezbollah says that it doesn't want any kind of a real full-scale armed conflict with Israel. So I don't think this is sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
The deaths of either Fuad Shukr or Ismail Haniyeh would be a major event in and of themselves. That they happened within less than 24 hours each other represents a major change in the trajectory of the situation in the Middle East. Joining me from Jerusalem with an analysis on the situation is Nimrod Gorin, Senior Fellow for Israeli Affairs with the Middle East Institute. What are your first impressions? The airstrike in Beirut, the airstrike in Tehran, the two senior leaders killed. What are your first impressions?
It gives Israelis a sense of achievement, of capability. that people didn't have for quite a while over here. On Beirut, there was anticipation for something to happen, so it was just a question of what and when. What happened in Tehran was a kind of total surprise. Seeing both of them happen in proximity showed that Israel is able to reach tactical achievements, but still very much lacks on strategy for how it gets out of this situation with its neighbors.
Is there any worry that this is going to lead to a larger regional war, particularly with Iran?
The immediate worry is the short-term escalation that is likely to happen, mostly from Lebanon, because you know, with Hezbollah, the level of the commander that was killed was really high. It was really clear that an attack on Beirut will bring Hezbollah to react in a way that they didn't do so in the last few months. With Haniyeh, it's a question of how much Iran will be the actor that will take the lead in retaliation or not, because you know, it's not an Iranian that was killed over there. Iran did indicate its willingness or commitment to respond, but I think first it will prefer to do so through its proxies in the region, and there are quite a number of those fighting Israel at the moment.
And what's the public sentiment in Jerusalem now? Are people happy?
People have not been happy in Israel, I think, since October 7th. So, you know, there's kind of a deep cloud over the society. People are very concerned about the fate of the hostages and what these developments will mean for them and for the talks to try and release them. So there's a lot of concern about that. But there is also this sense of accomplishment that lifts some people up, but again raises many questions about the overall direction beyond these immediate gains. And that's a question that was all around Netanyahu's visit to Washington last week, when people were asking what's the eventual goal, what's the policy endgame that Netanyahu is leading to. And I think now the question is very much still the same. Okay, so we have like this couple of wins against an axis of resistance, but then what? How do we bring back the security, the sense of security, bring back people to where they lived before, advancing some sort of peace and regional cooperation, bringing back the hostages? All of that is still left unanswered.
Well, bringing back the hostages, peace and security for a post-war Gaza, all of that would need to be negotiated. And now that Haniyeh is dead, those negotiations are kind of on hold, aren't they?
They will be on hold, and they were put on hold in previous instances during this war when there was some sort of an event that escalated. But even when they were taking place, they really didn't lead anywhere, because these negotiations on the ceasefire have been going on since January with a lot of investment by the U.S. president, a lot of efforts by different mediators to push them forward. And eventually, neither of the sides, not Netanyahu nor Hamas, actually went all the way in order to seal a deal. And so there is frustration about this process. It is basically not reaching the intended goal. And in the meantime, more and more of the hostages are reportedly losing their lives. So there is a sense of urgency. And now that the negotiation will be stopped for some period of time in which this cycle will evolve, maybe those that mediated should take a bit to reflect on why it failed until now and what could be done in the coming months to change that, because President Biden committed just last week that during his remaining months in office, he will do whatever he can to reach this deal and end the war and bring back the hostages and advance stability and peace. So maybe there's an opportunity there, but it may require a different sort of actions.
Do you think the assassination in Tehran makes peace easier or harder to attain?
I think any military escalation eventually puts additional obstacles in the way. But if it would have been leveraged correctly, you know, because both of these incidents could be projected to the Israeli public as a win, after which one can go and compromise more. If that was on the agenda of the prime minister, that's not necessarily the case.
Nimrod Gorn is a senior fellow for Israeli affairs at the Middle East Institute. Mr. Gorn, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you very much.
In a televised address Wednesday evening in Jerusalem, just as this show is wrapping up production, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the public.
אזרחי ישראל היקרים, ערב טוב. מאז תחילת המלחמה,
He acknowledged Israel's involvement in the death of the Hezbollah leader, but didn't mention Haniyeh's death. He praised his military for its bravery and strength. He praised Israeli citizens for their resiliency, but he gave no statements on what's next, other than to say that Israel is prepared for any scenario. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Climate change and politics coming up in a few minutes. Now it's time for an update on the situation in Ukraine. Russia launched dozens of drones towards Ukraine in a massive attack starting Tuesday night, and the Ukrainian military is growing thanks to the new conscription law. We get the details from our correspondent, Anna Chernikova, in Kyiv.
Russian forces launched a massive drone attack across Ukraine, starting in the late Tuesday through the night to Wednesday morning. The main target of the attack this time was Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. Ukrainian air defense reported destroying all 89 incoming drones, including more than 40 in Kyiv alone. This was the seventh drone attack on Kyiv in July and the most massive since beginning of this year. The air alert in the capital lasted for 9 hours. Andriy Yusov, the representative of the Ukrainian intelligence service, reported that two Russian strategic bombers were damaged during an attack on the Olenya airfield in the Murmansk region of Russia on July 25th. According to Yusov, it may take Russians several months to restore these jets, and during the attack, Russian air defense did not respond. Earlier this week, there was information about the attack on the Russian military airfields Olenya, Dyagilevo, and Engels. Ukrainian intelligence does not officially confirm or deny Ukraine's involvement in these attacks. In other news, the New York Times reports that according to experts, on condition of anonymity, since May, Ukraine has been conscripting up to 30,000 people into the army per month. This is 2 or 3 times more than it was in the winter period and about the same number as Russia does. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And in France, only days into the Paris Olympics, France has already weathered attacks on its rail and internet service, but it's also mounted a massive security umbrella that includes tens of thousands of police and soldiers. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
A morning patrol in northeastern Paris. Many Parisians have left on summer holiday. There aren't many tourists around, but these troops are on alert. Sergeant Jan heads this unit of paratroopers on patrol for security purposes. He only gives his first name. He says the troops are going to be vigilant for any environment and be prepared to intervene against threats or problems an ordinary person could have. The soldiers are housed in several spots around Paris, including here at Camp Mimoun, on the edge of the city, which can fit up to 4,500 troops. It's equipped with sleeping, sports, and eating facilities. This cafeteria serves up more than 2,000 meals. These parachutists are a long way from missions in Iraq and the Sahel, where some have done duty. Chief Sergeant Charlie served in Gabon, the Central African Republic, Ivory Coast, and Mali.
Donc le Mali, c'était une mission assez rustique.
He says Mali was a rustic mission, 3 months of non-stop desert as part of an anti-terrorism mission in the three frontier region of Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso.
Dans la région des trois frontières, c'est-à-dire Mali.
He and his colleagues are part of Operation Sentinelle, a homeland security mission first launched in 2015 after the Paris terrorist attacks. Chief Sergeant Charlie was there. The troops are also under threat. Today, one soldier survived a stabbing attack earlier this month. The suspect was arrested. They put in marathon days starting at 5 a.m. and ending after midnight. Captain Corentin is also helping to keep the Olympics safe.
We have to secure the place where there are a lot of people, like the train station or the scene of the river, the scene, you know. On the fan zone.
and answer questions from visitors, including directions to various locations.
I am very proud of to be here for the Games because, you know, the last time it's about 100 years, the Olympic Games take place in Paris. So it's one time in a lifetime. So.
Many people seem happy to have the extra security.
Bonne idée, bien sûr, oui, oui.
Paris resident Chantal Istolainen says it's good to have the troops around, ensuring people's safety. Some of these soldiers hope they'll have time to attend some Olympic events. If not, they'll be like many sports fans worldwide, following the games on TV. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
Residents of Houston, Texas, were just recently hit by a deadly hurricane, and then a severe heat wave made things like power outages caused by the hurricane harder to endure. Many weather events like storms, heat waves, floods, and droughts are made worse by climate change and then further compounded when they happen simultaneously like they did in Houston. As the U.S. is in the throes of its election season, Manon Donahue, a senior researcher with the Brookings Institution, is talking with Kylie Vaughn about why he believes the effects of climate change and the idea of taking action against it should not be a partisan issue.
In your article, you said compound disasters such as this one undermine basic functions of government and jeopardize the foundational tenets of American democracy. How exactly is this happening?
You know, we're at a point where the rubber is kind of hitting the road, and climate change impacts are becoming more of an infrastructural and an economic issue than just, an issue of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. They're confronting people in an everyday way, and the more that happens, the more difficult they are to ignore, even for politicians which don't want to take action on climate change or see it as a political liability.
So why do you believe addressing climate change is still a partisan issue?
You know, unfortunately, in the U.S., climate change, I think, has become a little bit of a dirty word for some people. Climate change itself, just the term, has become somewhat of a signifier for political allegiance. That's not, in my opinion, the way it should be, and it's not the way that it is perceived in the majority of other countries. But in the U.S., that's not necessarily the case. While there's a majority of Americans view it as a threat, 54%, it's a low majority. And it's kind of at odds with the number of people that are subject to extreme events. And this is an issue because when you don't have bipartisanship on climate policies, they're likely to be used as a political tool to win political points and remove protections for residents. You know, and while this in the short term can be a political win for some politicians and parties, in the long term, it creates a situation that puts more Americans at risk of extreme events, more at risk of loss and damage, of damage to property, and also being put in life-threatening situations. So, you know, from my perspective, what I would love to see is climate change addressed in a similar way to how we think about targeting economic growth, for example. You know, a long-term policy target, which is agreed upon by all parties as being something important to reach for, and just debate around the path to get there, not the fact that we need to take climate action itself.
So do you believe this type of shift is possible policy-wise, and can it happen before it's too late?
Yeah, I do think it's possible. You know, I think, unlike some of my colleagues, I'm an optimist, and I think it's important to keep an optimism as well and not get drawn into these worries of not being able to do anything, because I think that can be paralyzing. I think there's a challenge in the U.S. specifically around the ways that we communicate on climate impacts. And what I hope to see is a more translation of climate change as being something that is really about greenhouse gas emissions, to talking about it in connection to people's everyday lives. You know, now disasters are happening in most Americans' backyards. Everybody's kind of got a climate change story. And I think that's what we need to do, is start bringing it closer to people's lives, talk about the way that it impacts your life, your well-being, your livelihood, your economic security, etc.
All right. Well, Manon Donahue is a senior research associate at the Brookings Institution. Manon, thank you for your time today.
No problem at all. Thank you.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.